This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Vietnam music. If you don't know who Creedence Clearwater Revival is, consider yourself counseled. You might want to check it out. They had some relatively prominent singers come out of the group. Joining me now is the older brother of one of my battle buddies. So Gary Static Kling is my battle buddy. So he and I were in Iraq together, and he was a division air officer, and just a mouthy dude, man. And so I get a text message the other day. Hey, Mac, I'm in my garage working, and I just ran across some stuff my brother does. You should probably have him on your show. Oh, really? What's he do? Well, here it is. Check it out. So joining us is the older brother of Gary. Gary's an F-18 pilot. They like to be called fighter pilots. Yeah, I'm a fighter pilot. It's the whole Tom Cruise homoerotic thing that they have going on. We don't really understand it. They do, though. But lo and behold, what's his older brother? Fighter pilot? No. He's a 0331 machine gunner. So the question for Chris Kling, how did you get a brother that skews to that side of the Marine Corps? And aren't you responsible for that? And do you want to apologize for everybody right at the start of the program?
Well, thanks for having me on. I'm surprised you would even allow me to be on, knowing where my brother comes from. But yes, I do feel the need to have a sincere apology to anybody listening. And I'll be honest with you, I don't really admit that my brother is an air winger. I've always told people he was an infantry officer, and then later he can come in and tell the truth and disparage himself, but I hopefully am not in the room then when that happens.
Wow, so you just straight up lie about it and then leave?
Yes. Look him right in the eyes. You can, what do you want me to say? Yes, he's an air winger.
You can tell that Chris is enlisted. He's not afraid to just slime it up right off the chute. All right, Chris, so we need to meet you. Actually Static, he was the planner and then the executor of the division's airplane around the Second Battle of Fallujah and all through 2004. So in spite of being, you know, personality challenged and not very funny, he's a he can do some airplaning. He did some quality work, so I cannot deny that. So Chris, we've got to find out about you. Born and raised where?
Born and raised in South Scottsdale, Arizona.
South Scottsdale. All right. Yep. And how does the Marine Corps get on your radar? You're going to high school. Were you raised with the Marine Corps? How does it get on your radar?
You know, I had a great grandfathers that served in the Army in World War II in Korea, and then my family skipped a couple of generations of anybody in the service, and I was the first one after, I think, two generations to join the service again. And I came out of high school kind of with no real plan. It didn't look like I was going anywhere. I felt a little pressure from my father to, I think, quote-unquote, do something with your life. And I started going to community college, and I was just bored. And I had a math teacher that called me out for being distracting in class, and she was kind of mean-spirited, and she just said, what are you doing here? Why don't you just go join the Marine Corps? And I literally left her class and went to see a recruiter, and I joined the Marine Corps that afternoon.
Are you kidding me? You know what? That is like a quintessential no-shitter Marine story. So this jackass teacher of mine, she like shits on me. Did you go back to class the next day and say, just so you know, I joined the Marine Corps?
I came home, I told my father and my mother, I was sure they would be distraught, they'd have problems with it. I said, Mom, Dad, I need to talk to you. I just joined the Marine Corps. Both of them just raised their hands, and they're like, hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Can we help you pack your bag? So
right.
Did you go back to class and tell her, thanks for the recommendation, I just did it?
I did. She didn't seem to care. She just glad I was going to be out of her class.
That's frustrating. That's frustrating. All right, so you joined the Marine Corps. How do you decide, you don't know shit about the Marine Corps, how do you decide, so did you go open contract and found your way to the grunts? How did you, because the O-331, not as smart as the O-341 or the Assault Man, but a little bit more intelligent than the O-311. How do you find your way to an MOS in the Marine Corps?
You're going to love this. So I did know a little bit about the Marine Corps. My best friend growing up's father had been in the Marine Corps in Korea, and he had these beautiful snapshots of him holding up Korean heads and, you know, dead body parts. And I don't know why I was so struck by it, but I had grown up in the Nam years, you know, so I watched Nam unfold in the TV, and I felt like I wanted to serve at some point. And so when I went into boot camp, I went in open contract, and I was very fit. I was a really good runner. I had been a runner in high school, and so I crushed the PFTs, and I crushed the written testing in boot camp. They made me the guide about halfway through, so I was carrying the guide on, and then I think it was the third or fourth highest shooter, and I ended up being the company honorman. I wore blues at graduation.
Nice.
And so one of the perks of being the company honorman is you get to pick your MOS, and so three drill instructors pulled me into their office, and this was back in 1984, and they said, you know, here's what, your test scores are good, you're qualified for a lot of stuff, what do you want to do? And my senior drill instructor had been a machine gunner, and I kind of liked who he was as a man, meaning really mean, and I said, I want to be a machine gunner, and they're like, no, hold up a second, you got a chance here to get a good career, to really do something and come out and have a career, what do you want to do? And I said, I'd like to be a machine gunner. And they kind of basically took me outside and rolled me in the pit a few times and had me sweat really hard and brought me back in and said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be a machine gunner. And finally they said, all right, sign up. And then as soon as I signed the paperwork, they were like, congratulations, that's an amazing choice. You are a true man. And congratulated me on my choice.
Wow, your first step into the inner sanctum. That is a cool story. It's a cool story, and so they thrashed you for thinking about being a machine gunner?
Say that again?
They took you out and they thrashed you? They took you to the sandbox?
Another choice. They wanted me to really think about it, and I was just adamant about it. I knew that's what I wanted to do.
So,
and I was confused. I remember being confused. Like, I thought they'd be proud of this. But in the end, of course, they were. But they just wanted to make sure that I had time to really think about what I was doing. And they were encouraging me in the way that drill instructors did back in the 80s to really think about what I was about to say or do.
You know what? You're absolutely right. And look how well it's turned out. So you go to School of Infantry. And then are you a heavy guns guy? Are you a weapons platoon M60 guy? What kind of machine gunner do you become?
So back then, so I got meritoriously promoted, so I went from private to PST. I went to infantry training school, and back then they trained me on both. You learned all the just basically M60 and 50 cal stuff, and we trained on both guns. And then from there, you would pull orders, and those orders would determine what kind of unit you went to. I graduated in the top 2% of my infantry training class. They promoted me again meritoriously to Lance Corporal, but I pulled orders after that to Subic Bay up to Kiwi Point for 18 months of barracks duty in the Philippines. Don't be jealous.
Well, most men didn't live through that, and you actually survived the experience and stayed on active duty. We may not get to the whole your life, your next life involved with helping people now that you've revealed that little nugget. So tell me about your career and we'll come back to life there. Because that in place in 1984 was a different place for young men.
It really was.
Okay.
Unspeakable. Only those that were there will ever know what it was like, but it was amazing. So I did 18 months there, and then I pulled orders to go back to the fleet to 1-7, and I joined Alpha Company and a weapons platoon when I got there.
Alpha Company, known as Animal Company.
Animal Company 1-7 weapons.
My my oldest was part of Animal Company. So he gets there, and he's like, I'm like, so what company are you in? He's like, Animal Company. I said, I think it's Alpha. No, Dad, we're the only company in the Marine Corps that gets to be called Animal, Baker, and Suicide Charlie. I said, okay, that stuff is lame and stupid, so don't even bring that shit home with me. To me.
You must have been to the 5th Marines, because they're the only ones that would say that.
First battalion, 5th Marines, how'd you know? And you were in 7th Marines back when men were men, and you guys were at San Mateo, yes? You guys, we hadn't moved
yet. We were in the north end of Pendleton. Now they're out at the stumps, so
they... Yeah, tell me, was there a better place? You've got some pretty sweet duty stations, man. Pendleton, right outside of San Clemente, that was sweet. Close to Orange County in Los Angeles, and Subic Bay. And so what do you do after you go to 1-7? Did you get out?
I went to 1-7, deployed back to Okinawa, did a spin over there. There was obviously no war at the time. It was 84, and the 88 was the year I served.
Right.
And so I did a couple of years and shifted around. I think I went back in 87. They refueled the Trident nuclear subs up in Bremerton, Washington, and there had been some sort of terrorist threat on that, so they pulled a whole bunch of Marines, and we went up there and did unusual and very secretive duty there for a while. But ended up, you know, just spent my time in 1-7, training, and then, 1988, I rolled out, went back to the civilian world.
Okay, so that's your Marine Corps career. All right,
that's my Marine Corps career.
Let's go back to Marine Barracks Subic Bay. All right.
Yeah, you're
going
to go back there.
Oh, come on. We have to. Because, okay, so explain what the city of Longapo was like in 1984.
So, as soon as you pass through the gates, you go over a river that they fondly called Ship River because of what it smelled like, and it was basically the sewage system for the city.
Right.
And immediately entered the street that was just nothing but nightclubs and bars and just about 10,000 Filipino prostitutes. Beer was 7 cents back then for the good beer. I think you could get a pint of gin or a pint of rum for about maybe $2, $1.50. And I mean, I compare it to heaven.
Okay, well, you let's talk about Shit River first of all. When you walked across the bridge, tell everybody what you saw down in the river.
So first of all, you would see just about 30 little boats with people panhandling down there. They were hoping you'd throw some change over to them. And garbage all over floating in the river. The majority of the homes along the edge were made out of wood, MRE boxes, cardboard. You know, I remember one year I was there and they had a big typhoon come through, and my parents called me and they're like, wow, we heard that there's like 10,000 people homeless. And I said, well, Mom, that was 3 days ago. They've all built their homes back up. It's just cardboard. They set it right back together.
And the whole concept of Shit River, Marines throwing money, they didn't try to throw it in the boats, right? You threw it in the water.
Yes and no. Depends on how evil you are of a human being, because they're going in after it if they can get it.
Right, right. The immune system in those kids that were in those boats, you could, inject them with typhus or, you know, some other disease, and their immune system would, annihilate it, within 15 minutes. No kidding.
Yes.
Right. We don't drink bottled water, right, and we're shitting for a week. These kids were like, immune system? Come on, man. Yeah.
They can drink raw sewage and they're fine. They just walk away.
They did drink raw sewage. I'm sure a lot of careers got destroyed down there. A lot of guys got in trouble. What was the
a lot
secret?
Of guys got in trouble. A lot of guys got married.
Yeah.
A lot of guys had babies.
What was the secret to, other than condoms, what was the secret of navigating all that at a really young age? I mean, can you imagine? I mean, think back. How old were you? You were 19, 20?
I was probably 21 when I got over there.
Okay, so you're 21 years old, and you get launched into that event. What's the secret? What's the secret to not, like, losing your mind and going to jail?
I don't know. You know, clearly there wasn't a secret because a lot of guys did get in big trouble over there. I credit my unit. Like, I was in a unit at Bravo Company, a bear studio, that we basically ran long-range patrols through the jungle, and we'd do that 7 days at a time. So we'd do 7 days in the jungle, we'd come out, clean weapons, get our gear ready, spend 3 days doing that, and then we'd have a 96. We'd have 4 days off pretty much the whole time I was there. 7 days in the jungle, 3 days clean weapons, 4 days in 96, and come back and do it again. So we had 4 days to just go berserk. But it was just short enough for me that I could rein it back in and come back in and spend the last day getting myself rehydrated and sobered up and go back out to the jungle.
And sweat it all out.
But I think if I'd had a jet on base where I could go out every night, it could have been bad.
Right. Right. I think you either learn to stay away from that a little bit, because otherwise it could ruin you as a human being.
It could ruin you as a human being. Yeah. In fact, it did.
Right. Now, I was there in, I went through there in 87 on my way to the Indian Ocean on the USS Ranger. And I wound up, one of my Marines got in trouble. The story's funny. the story's funny. So all the prostitutes know when, like, the ships are leaving and things like that. So two nights before we were supposed to pull out of port, he's trying to get back to the ship. A buddy has his ID, rolls into a bar he was in earlier. One of the prostitutes says, Johnny B, you buy me drinks. He's like, I got no money. Leave me alone. I'm looking for so-and-so. No, you buy me drink. And she, like, goes to grab him, and he just takes his hand and, like, you know, extends his arm, doesn't shove her. She acts like he's hit her, and she, like, falls on a table and screams, right? So the funny part of the story is he's about 5'5", Johnny Bennington from Connecticut. And a sailor, like 6'3", stands up, and he's like, hey, what are you doing? And Bennington looks at him and says, you think I'm a fucking afraid of you? I got my ass kicked by guys way bigger than you. Come on, dude. And the Marines that were with him said, if you could have seen the look on this kid's face when Bennington looked at him, it was hilarious. He was like, nah, we're good. So anyway, Bennington gets arrested. I have to go out to the local police station out there on, I don't know what the name of the street, Masaisai Street or something like that. Right. Yeah. And it's an open air police station. We have to wait for her from 8 at night or 7 at night till midnight. If she shows up, they settle out of court and he can go home with us. If they don't settle out of court, he's got to stay, right, on legal hold in the Philippines. So this is just a straight up extortion play that the prostitutes are in on it. And I'm sure the cops were in on it too. I'm sure the cops got a cut of it. Because the going rate was like $250 for him to settle out of court. And so, anyway, so needless to say, she never showed up because some of my other Marines went and paid her bar fine and were with her the rest of the night. So Bennington and I had to sit there for like 5 hours, just the whole world drunker than shit. So I'm looking in the police station, and I looked in the short patrol station as we've left the base, and there's guys that have been deserter and deserter status in the Philippines since the Vietnam War.
Yep. Lots of them, actually.
Yeah, and you see their names on the wall. Like, you're, you know, so-and-so, 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 so-and-so. You're like, holy shit, man. So that place ruined a lot of people. All right, let's shift gears. You get out, so you leave the Marine Corps, you survive your time in the Philippines. Then what do you do? So you're a smart guy. You've got time in the Marine Corps, and now you're looking for a career. What do you do?
You know, I flounder. Honestly, I get out of the Corps and I started working. I was, you know, I was pretty fit. I hit the gym a lot when I was in the Corps, so I got out and I got a job at Sears, like arrested shoplifters and had jobs like that. I never really launched. I didn't go back to college. I took the college money that the Marine Corps gave me and I blew it. And I started to really have problems with alcohol. In fact, started getting arrested for drunk driving a number of times in the years following, 4 total.
Wow. How'd you not go to jail?
I did go to jail.
How was jail?
I got locked up and just was really struggling. I remember coming back from the Corps and working at Sears, and just I felt like I was in the wrong place in the wrong time. I really seriously contemplated trying to go back to the Marine Corps 2 or 3 or 4 times. And, but I just wasn't going anywhere. And then I think, what year did we go over to Kuwait? That year.
91?
Yeah, when they lit all the, right. They lit all the oil fields on fire. I got word that my unit was on their way over to Kuwait and I tried to reenlist again then. I still wasn't doing anything with my life, and they wouldn't guarantee, I think they had a ton of people trying to reenlist or enlist, and they didn't seem interested in it. They certainly weren't going to guarantee me a chance to go back to my unit, and so I got stalled out. But those years would not be good years for me, and they wouldn't get good for me until 2006. I just kind of continued on I would hold menial jobs, and I went from alcohol into marijuana into hard drugs and just really began to struggle in those later years.
So what brings this, it all comes to a head, and under what conditions? And then and talk to me.
So I somewhere about the late 90s, I was continuing my downward spiral. And I got into hard drugs, particularly methamphetamine, and then became an IV user of methamphetamine. And through the late 90s into the early 2000s, my life just, you know, was about what you'd expect for somebody who's doing that on a daily basis. A lot of homelessness, a lot of low-level crime just to feed my addiction. And I would say probably about 2004, to 2006, my last 2 years out there, I was pretty much chronically homeless and was also deeply suicidal. And I'm not sure how I lived through that period of time, to be honest with you. But one day in 2006,
okay.
I stood up.
How did you? How did you
do this anymore?
How did you not kill yourself? I mean, you had to know how. You had to know how. You're familiar with weapons, so that's not an issue.
Yeah, I wrote the letter twice. I wrote my family a detailed letter basically apologizing to them for making them watch what I was doing to myself and
right.
and for the pain and suffering of all that stuff associated with it, and I just couldn't pull it off. And finally, in April of 2006, I literally stood up one day and just broke, was emotional, and just said, I've had enough, and I ended up walking all the way across town to a little halfway house over in Phoenix that was in the middle of the ghetto. I hadn't spoken to my family in about 5 years. And they, you know, they would hear reports of me panhandling here or getting arrested there. But they just hadn't really had much contact with me at all. And I stood up and went to a halfway house one day and got genuine about needing some help. And some people got around me and helped me. And I got sober in April of 2006. I've been sober ever since.
Okay. So you get sober. A lot of people get sober and then lapse back because they don't find a direction. What happens to you?
So about a year into my recovery, I had a good buddy who I met in recovery who had been inspirational to me, and he asked me to come work at this detox. It was a detox that primarily catered to homeless and indigent people in the Phoenix area. They had a contract with Phoenix police. Like, the people that were in there had no money, homeless. A lot of them had been picked up at a bus stop, intoxicated, or beat up on the street, and the cops would bring them in. And the place was scary. A lot of people had a hard time working there. We'd see people start and walk out the same day. And I show up on this unit, and there's three other Marines working there, all Marines. One of them in particular had done three tours in Afghanistan and had a bunch of bullet holes in him, and huge guy, and they kind of welcomed me into the unit, and they kind of taught me how to work with these people, you know, and offer them some hope, but also meet them at their level, and I fell in love with the job. I don't know what, but I literally fell in love with working with these people, and having been where they had been and knowing those dark days, I just really connected to the work. From there, I think I worked there 3 years, and then I went on to work in a couple of treatment centers here in town, and I worked on another detox at one point. So this was a medical detox that I originally worked at, and I started to put this career together and started to make pretty darn reasonable money, considering I had never gone to college. And I would say along that path is where I got into the work that I do now.
Which is? Tell me what you do now.
So today, I'm a professional interventionist. I work with a buddy that trained me in this a few years ago, and I fly around the country, and I work with families that are trying to intervene on their loved ones who are not only struggling with addiction or alcoholism, but are also struggling to decide that they want help. You know, they're on the fence, and they're just not able to fully engage in any kind of treatment path, and an interventionist will then help the family orchestrate some conversations to see if we can't get them to swing that leg over the fence and jump into recovery in a more full fashion.
All right. Before we get to that, the intervention piece of this thing, because I want to talk about that, but I want to talk about, there's a lot of families that live with somebody like you in their lives, right?
Yeah.
And then you turn around and you began to help those kind of people and ultimately those families. What would you tell people that, what do you do with somebody that's chronically, alcohol dependent, drug dependent, you know, might be homeless, what do you do if you're a family? Because most of these families have lived the hell of watching somebody they loved and love just destroy their lives. And then ultimately, I think families do what families have to do, which is you can only let them into the inner sanctum so long and let them annihilate the place before you do what you have to do, which is you put them at distance. You can come to here, but you can't come inside here, okay? So they've gone through all that, and now this person is, right, rarely seen. You know, so they're in some phase of that. What do you give advice to families that are dealing with that?
Sure. Most of the families don't like the advice that we give, which is we give a sort of a tough love, hardline approach, meaning the verbiage that we use with our family members like this is always kind and supportive and loving. We always tell them, hey, I love you. I believe in you. I know you can get help. But the problems are that families kind of act out of love, and alcoholics and addicts have a way of manipulating and controlling over the years their family to be supported in the wrong ways, meaning we pay for their cell phone, we buy them a car, we let them live in our house, we pay their rent, you know, we do all these things. And one of the first pieces of advice we do, we look at these pieces with the family and we're like, you got to pull all this back. Like, you can't pay for any of this. You know, the primary piece that we look at is pain and suffering. So pain and suffering for the addicts is really the only thing that will ever and to get them to a place where they'll stop. Pain and suffering is the ultimate teacher for somebody struggling with addiction. And what we encourage families to do is never, ever remove any of the pain and suffering from these people's lives. If they're making decisions based on self that lead them to pain and suffering, then they need to feel the full weight of that pain and suffering in order to change direction. And so this is tough information for families to hear. This, you know, it's one thing if the guy's a 50-year-old male alcoholic. It's another thing if it's your 18-year-old heroin-addicted daughter, you know, to put her on the street, to remove her rent, to take her car or whatever away is very difficult for families to think about or do, but it's actually in the end going to be the only real way they can help.
Yeah, you know, my family went through that. Actually, I had a younger sister die of exposure when she was living in Indiana in the winter and left the apartment windows open and drank herself in some kind of state of alcohol poisoning. And then that, the alcohol acting as a depressant combined with the cold air, killed her. And, but it's just, she was so destructive, you know, and she had every gift that God could give a human being. Good looking, smart, personality, athletic, all of it. And, but she had demons. And so I would imagine, so families don't want to hear that, do they? You got it.
They, you know, usually when you tell them these things, they shake their heads and they're like, "We no." In fact, a lot of times when I work with a family, I'll ask them before we get into any work, I'll say, "Listen, I want you to write down a list of things that you've been doing for your loved one that you think, in order to help, that you think might actually not be helping." And typically, they'll tell you right then and there what they're doing that's inappropriate. They know. They just can't stop doing it.
Interesting. My guest is Chris Kling. He's a 0331 machine gunner, honor grad from boot camp, MCRD, where real Marines get made, and also survived barracks duty in Subic Bay, and then lived a life on the streets as a. How would you label yourself as a drug addict?
I mean, junkie, technically, IV drug user.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Chris does interventions. And so this whole path of trying to help somebody, we just talked about one piece, and that is, you know, what do you do for somebody who's going down this road? Because you desperately want to help. But bottom line is people that find themselves in these circumstances, they probably exploited your help to death, and now there needs to be a little bit of a different approach. So we'll take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next with Chris Kling right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nelson. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com. And I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255. And press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on Armoring Radio on the All Warriors Radio Network.
Like guitars, this is one of the great bumpers for guitar lovers. It's a song by a group named Filter. We continue here on Almarine Radio, and our guest, former machine gunner, former drug addict, former homeless guy, Chris Klang. He's the younger brother of Gary Static Klang. Do you call him Static or Gary? What do you call him?
I mean, I struggle. I just call him Airwinger. I call him weak-spirited, but I just do call him Gary.
Gary, all right. Yeah, the whole call sign thing is something that most families don't really take to. Who? Oh, yeah, because I guess all the Klangs could be call sign Static then, if that was the case. So
yeah, it's true.
All right, let me ask you a question about something that's happening around the country, and that is a lot of communities are spending a lot of money on houses and all kinds of services for drug-addicted people, opium people up in San Francisco. I'd be curious about your thoughts on all of that. That's not exactly tough love. Is it more simply subsidizing their way of life and not trying to get them to a better place? What are your thoughts on that?
So it's a super interesting question, and you know, honestly, I don't think it's a solution. I still work up here in Arizona with closely with some guys that work for a company that actually participated in this. You know, this company has bought up a whole bunch of apartments and offered these people homes and places to go, but they're not getting well. You know, they're loaded in their houses. A lot of them have these houses assigned to them and won't even go there. They still sleep out on the streets. They're still getting very intoxicated. So I think my thoughts around it are, it probably helps the city clean itself up a little bit and get some homeless people off the street. And so it might have to do with the aesthetics of the city. But I don't see it as any kind of a solution. And the guys that work in the midst of it don't. You know, they're frustrated by it. They're like, these guys are not getting well. But when you mix in the component of addiction with, you know, other serious mental health issues, there really is kind of a lack of. So there's pretty good programs out there for people with substance abuse, even substance abuse that's complicated with trauma or PTSD or, you know, things like that. But where mental health meets substance most of them are state-run, not well-funded. And so these are the people that chronically just can't get well, and those are the ones that are trying to house and get off the street. So I don't want to be too judgmental of the programs, but I can tell you that these are not people that are getting well. They're not people that are getting sober that I see too often.
Right. No, I think you're right. There's this tremendous desire to help, right? And as you said, it might help in terms of getting people off the streets so that the business people are happy. But if your end goal is to ultimately change their lives and point their lives in a different direction, probably not going to happen through that kind of a program. But I guess we'll see. Talk about, Gary, talk about intervention. How you got into this line of work, and because I think we all have a vision of what intervention is. We've seen them on TV, right? And, you know, I love to watch them, right? Oh, here it comes, right? You got the whole family there, and there's so much anger pent up in this intervention. You're just waiting for it to go sideways, and it'll be like the Jerry Springer show on steroids. Yeah, no shit, right? I mean, everybody is like this person who you're going to do the intervention with. I can just speak for my family. There's years and years of frustration, anxiety, and bitterness as everybody has had events, parts of their lives screwed up by this person who they look at, and although they love them, they've had enough, right? And there's a lot of, I mean, that's like barely under the surface. The surface barely covers that. So how'd you get into it, and then what's the point of it if it's done well, and how does it work?
Sure. So I got into it kind of in a natural way. I was doing admissions work for treatment centers where, you know, people were just calling in and asking about treatment and what do you guys offer, you know, how much does it cost? But inevitably, when you're in conversations like that, you get into ones where they're like, well, I'm looking for my husband, but he doesn't really want to go. So even though I'm doing the investigation work, he's not sure he wants to go get help. And you end up in conversations with them, or you drive over and visit them, or they come to see you, and you end up talking to them face-to-face and kind of helping people wrap their heads around a new direction, you know, a completely different way of life than what they've been living. And I ended up doing a lot of transport work. I was working for other interventionists that were doing interventions on people, and then those people had to be transported from, say, you do the intervention in California, but for whatever reason they're sending them to Florida for treatment, and they need somebody to go with them. They're intoxicated, they're sometimes partially in withdrawal from opiates, and they got to go through three airports and, you know, three layovers and land in Florida and get there in one piece and not get drunk in the airport. And so I ended up with this job where I'm transporting people around the country, and you get to, again, learn to have a lot of interesting conversations with people that are not on their best days. You know, they're not soaring into this on the wings of victory. They're struggling desperately. And through that, I had a couple of interventionists that I worked with that really started to encourage me to take on this line of work. They liked the way that I worked with their clients, and they liked the way that I talked to the families, and so one of them in particular, his name's Keith Bradley, works out of Colorado. This guy's a seasoned interventionist, kind of took me under his wing and began to formally train me. And that's how I got into the line of work. He kind of eventually cut me loose on my own. And so I do interventions at the rate of about one a week, every week. And I've been doing that here for a couple of years now.
All right, so talk to us about...
From a standpoint of, you know, how they work or what they do, I'll first back up a little bit and make a comment. You know, when you talk about people know what interventions look like, primarily because of the show Intervention, you know, that is a pretty accurate portrayal of what interventions look like, but keep in mind that TV makes things more dramatic than it actually is, and they typically pick the most dramatic interventions probably to put on TV. A lot of them are not quite that insane, and you know, in fact, a good interventionist job, when I get on the phone with a family, the first thing I tell them is that an intervention is essentially an interventionist themselves are not special people with special skills. we are basically there to help the family negotiate the conversations. And what we're trying to do, the reason we write letters and everyone reads letters, is because we have an opportunity to try to orchestrate near-perfect language. We really want to be careful and thoughtful with what we say to this person. We want to be direct and confront the problem, but we also want to be super loving and encouraging and know that these people are embedded in shame and guilt and remorse for what they've done, whether they present that or not. That's their reality. And so we have to try to find language that can penetrate that and really encourage them and show them that we believe in them, but then also directly confront them on the reality of how this is affecting us, how it's affecting them, and then we have to boldly ask them to go, you know, to treatment. So
when you say
it's complex, I would tell you the vast majority of the work around an intervention is not with the actual person we're intervening on. It's with the family, because like you said, they are angry. They are, you know, they're not only are they just outright angry and with good reason, with legitimate reason, they're scared. You know, they're scared to death. They think their loved one's going to die. You don't call an interventionist just because a guy got a DUI or had a bad week or missed work, you know.
Okay, can I throw one?
Here I go with the family and try to help them orchestrate loving thought. They're just not there. You know what I mean?
Right.
It can take a lot of conversations, sometimes individual work or face-to-face work with the family where we really have to talk about anger and how effective it is. And I typically tell the family, say, if anger worked, you would have never called me because you've been angry for a long time. If you would have, if you could just crush him with anger and he would get well, you wouldn't need me.
Well, hey, Gary, one other part of it is fear, too. Because, I mean, you were a grown man. Like, are you going to get pissed after this happens? And are you going to come back around? And are you going to assault me? Are you going to take it out on me? And so, I know family members that, you know, did an intervention and the mother changed she wouldn't read what she wrote. Like, you know, she, but when confronted with it, she was afraid because, the kid was violent. And so she went through all the steps, right? And then she wrote the letter. But when it came time to read probably the most gut wrenching part of the letter, she opted not to do that. And everybody else sitting there was like, oh, wow. You know, and then there was bad blood because of that. Interesting.
Yeah, and you know you're dealing with people who maybe just used huge amounts of powerful stimulants, or have been up for days on end and are in the state of psychosis, seeing things and hearing things that aren't there. Obviously, we try to orchestrate an intervention at a time when the person would be least inebriated, but again, a lot of times people are around the clock intoxicated, so you don't have a choice. You just got to rush in there. And is there a chance for violence? Yeah, you bet. There sure is. Is there a chance for anger and screaming and horrific, you know, name calling? Yeah, all the time. Which is again why we, as a team, kind of have to go in with really well thought out wording and then, you know, we try to stay together no matter how the person being intervened on reacts. We try to just stay the course and remain gentle and be kind, you know, and deliver our statements in a matter-of-fact way, loving at the beginning and then directly confronting the problem as we see it and then asking them to go get help.
Okay, so is part of being an interventionist having a couple people with you that if it does get physical that you can stop it?
You know, I do them by myself and with the family. And typically what we say is if the person gets violent or whatever, you know, lays hands on anyone, let's try to stop it and then just step back. Like, we'll leave. We're not going to stay there. I shouldn't say that. There are times when I'll stand my ground, but in a gentle way, you know, in a non-threatening way. Because a lot of times addicts are going to use anger as their weapon to get you to leave. You know, and so you have to be willing to sit through a lot of it in the beginning and just say, look, I get that you're angry, but no one here is trying to harm you. You know, they always talk about being ambushed. I'm being ambushed. And I'm like, listen, ambushes occur by the enemy. I want you to look around the room here. What you have in this room are the people that love you the most in the world. There's not an ambush. If it's an ambush, it's an ambush of love, and there's nothing to fear. And usually we can get them to calm down. You know, they're going to get mad anyway, and they're going to stay mad for a few minutes, and men will often threaten violence. But if you can stand through it, they usually calm down. Now, if they're, you know, on stimulants and they're going to hurt people, then we just leave. We'll walk out. Or we get the police involved. You know, it's not uncommon to call the police and have the police lock them up. And then, you know, 2 days later when they're getting out of jail, we're ready to try again. We'll catch them again coming out the door. Now they haven't used it in a couple of days. And recently have been incarcerated. They're sometimes a little soft and more open to the approach. And so most interventionists will tell you one of their favorite places to do an intervention is in a hospital or in a jail because people are all of a sudden a little more compliant and easier to work with.
So when is the appropriate time to do an intervention?
So I think the appropriate time is a very personal question, personal to each family. And obviously, you're going to have a person who is in dire straits. You know, they're throwing away their health, they're throwing away their family, they're throwing away their freedom, they're throwing away their finances. And usually, by the time I get involved, the family has already approached them multiple times. Please get help, please get help. You know, get help, do something. And they're just swatting away that idea, saying no, 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 no. In other words, the family themselves are not getting anywhere, or it's complicated, and the family needs a professional, somebody who understands addiction and all of the intricacies of dependency, but also understands just the nuances of that level of suffering and shame, you know. And so I think the fact that I was intervened on, my father intervened on me, so I've been through an intervention on the other end. And I think people appreciate that. But really, one of the more valuable things that good interventionists will bring to the table is that we are comfortable with all of the normal objections that people have. You know, I don't want to do this because I don't believe in it. It's religious. I'm not a religious person. I can't because of my job. I can't because of my work. I don't think I have a problem. My family needs to mind their own business. All of these typical objections come up, and the family doesn't know what to say. You know, they just keep coming at them with the same thing that's not been working. And so a good interventionist will be well-versed in all of these things and able to have a different kind of a conversation that usually the addict can hear a little bit better.
All right, you do it professionally. What's the name of your company?
So I work for a company called Love in Action Intervention and Training.
Okay. Talk to me about people that will listen to this. How do you find a good interventionist?
So it's interesting that you say this because there's no real oversight into interventionists nationwide. There are certifications and things like that you can get. But even the certifications are really just usually sold by other interventionists that don't want to do interventions anymore. So they have these, you know, companies that quote unquote certify you. But there's actually no real oversight into interventionists. And so I think one of the things you want to do is be referred to one. You know, a lot of treatment centers work with interventionists all the time, and they are typically going to use professionals that have a lot of experience and that have been trained appropriately. And so being referred to an interventionist, then you can call any good treatment center, you know, a reputable treatment center, and ask them to refer you an interventionist, and they almost always will have several that they can put you in touch with. If you go online and Google, you know, Google's good for whatever Google's good for, so you risk a little bit more, but like I said, if there was any kind of oversight or legitimacy around this, it might be easier to do, but there's not. So I would say that people that are, you know, certified intervention professionals probably at least have been doing it for a while and are at least paying for a certification somewhere. And some interventionists are in fact therapists as well. You know, they're licensed therapists. And so while they're not actually doing therapy per se, with the individual, they can sometimes do therapy with the family. So they'll, you know, they'll do the intervention on the client, but then they will work with the family as actual therapists and do long-term therapy. I am not a therapist, so I work with the individual. I get the intervention done, and then I refer the family to local therapists or family programs that can help them, because family is typically very sick as well. You know, they need a lot of attention. While this person is in treatment, doing 30 or 60 days of residential treatment, the family's not getting any help. And so when he comes out, he feels better. He's had just tons of, you know, individual therapy and group therapy, and the family's had nothing. They're still just as mad as the day he went in. And so if the family doesn't go after some help, too, and do that in conjunction with the individual getting help, usually it's set up for chaos when he returns home. You know, there's always a breakdown, and everybody's mad at each other again, even though this guy has done, you know, invested himself pretty thoroughly in treatment. There will be fights and bad things occur.
Do you go, Chris, you go anywhere in the country? Obviously, if somebody calls you and says, hey, we'd like to work with you, you can do a lot of work, I'm sure, over the phone and things like that. But do you travel to do this, or you just do it around your home?
Travel all over the country. You know, typically we get the letters written, like we send out letter writing instructions and get the family to begin working on the letters. We do some conference calls around coaching them to make sure that they understand what the letters should look like and sound like. We send them some example letters. But then we get on the phone and we begin to talk about the details. And so we can get a lot of that done, you know, from where I'm at. And then usually I will fly out to wherever the intervention is, and we'll do a face-to-face family meeting the day before the actual intervention and then intervene the next day. So I'm usually out. Sometimes it's a one-day deal. We do the family meeting in the morning and the intervention at night. Sometimes I do the family meeting the night before and then intervene the next morning. But I'm usually out for a day, day and a half when I come home.
All right. So when I begin to look at somebody, if I'm interested, what do I look at? Those some kind of credential. What's going to tell me that they're worth a shit? And if somebody was interested and is working with somebody, could they give you a call and say, hey man, I could use some help in terms of figuring this out? Do you mind people doing that?
Not at all. In fact, I do, you know, I help with resources all the time for all over the country. A lot of, you know, the families that I work with usually will stay with me for sometimes a year or more, right. You know, when their loved one gets out of treatment, where should we send them for aftercare, what right. Kind of therapist, you know, what kind of family program. So I'm used to providing resources nationwide, and I have a lot of great professional-level resources that I can tap into all over the country to get great advice if it's from a part of the world that I'm not familiar with. But, yes, like we definitely can help with any resources or any questions around, you know, treatment or interventionists. You know, as an interventionist, a lot of times families come to us and don't have any idea where to go for treatment. So another piece you would expect a good interventionist to have is really good feedback about various treatment facilities. And one of the gray areas, or an area of concern, is if you get an interventionist on the phone and they are adamant that you go to this particular facility, you probably have stumbled on somebody of these programming clients, meaning they are not concerned about this facility. The facility is paying them a kickback. Right. So, you know, an interventionist should be paid by the family, not by the facility. In fact, if a facility pays an interventionist, it's considered unethical. It's called client brokering, like we're having you bring us these clients and talk to the family about the needs of the client and their financial needs, and then help them find, you know, the right facility, no matter where that is, and make sure that it's financially in their budget, but also that it's a good, sound facility. And usually we're going to offer multiple ideas. Sometimes the families will call me and say, we've done research, we like this facility, what do you think? And then we'll give them feedback on that. But an interventionist should never be grounded in like one idea, like, oh, you have to go here, this is the only place. That's a giant red flag.
All right, give your contact information.
So my first name is Chris, C-H-R-I-S, last name is Kling, K-L-I-N-G. And my my email address is cclang422@yahoo.com. And my cell, which is my work cell, is 602-465-2766. And if you want to go to the website and see what Keith and I do, our website is it's www.loveinactionus.com.
All right. Two more questions. One, what haven't I asked you? This is kind of the general article. What haven't I asked, been smart enough to ask you that people should know about what you do, about this, about intervening? What haven't I been smart enough to ask you?
I mean, the questions have been good. I think one of the things that people are sometimes afraid to investigate an intervention until they actually are well past needing one. You know, there's no harm in calling an interventionist or a company and just asking what's entailed and finding out a little bit about not only the interventionist themselves, but what it means. And then you can make a better, a more informed decision on whether you want to do one or not. People sometimes, I think, wait too long. They wait until things are, police are involved and bad things are occurring. And it's just, partially it's guilt. A lot of times families feel like they're doing this to their loved one. And, you know, instead of for their loved one, and I don't know how that dynamic works, but we see a lot of it. Sometimes people will get halfway into an intervention, and then they'll call you and go, I shouldn't do this to them, like it's going to be harmful to them, and so, you know, that, while that's not typically the case, it's sometimes good just to be able to get on the phone and talk to people about what it is to do this. Do I really need to do one? I think an interventionist will help a family. If a family hasn't tried to intervene themselves, if they haven't had some good, healthy conversations themselves, they should. You don't necessarily want to pull the trigger on a formal intervention if just everybody in the family hasn't had the balls yet to step up and have a direct conversation with their loved one. And that's hard to do, and we get that, but I think a good interventionist could give you advice over the phone about how to approach your loved one in a healthier way. And then if you still can't get them to go and things are, you know, continuing to decompensate, but then you can, you know, consider a professional. But I think a little coaching goes a long ways, and some families can have their own success without the need of a full-blown hiring and, you know, a professional to come out and do the whole thing.
Okay, and then a final question about two families that are struggling with somebody who's just absolutely lost their way in a destructive manner, both towards their own family and towards themselves. A final word for them?
You know, I guess my first thoughts are be gentle, be loving. The anger doesn't work. I think you would have to begin to withdraw all financial support. You do not want to financially support these people. That money is going to buy them drugs. And if they should get to the point where they pass, you know, and die of this disease, you do not want to look down into that grave site and say, I provided the funds in which they did this. You have to get tough on the money and withdraw all financial support. But at the same time, you have to push forward with your heart and make sure that this person knows that we love you. We support you. If you decide to take a path of recovery, we will support you all the way through, but we will not support any other path. We're not supporting any ideas you have. This is the idea that we think will work, and of that, we're supportive. But you just have to stay gentle. The anger makes things worse. It does not get better. Guilt or shame does not make things worse. You know, I remember phone calls from my brother. As much as I've taken shots at him today, when I was in the midst of my disease, my brother talked to me like a Marine. I'd get on the phone, I'd be in self-pity, I'd be looking for money, and my brother would just say, Chris, I love you. I know you can do this. I know you can figure out a way out. You know, I'm not going to send you any money. But he was just supportive, you know, and that was super meaningful to me at the time. I mean, when I called, I wanted money. But what he gave me was much more valuable. You know, he gave me belief in myself on a day when I didn't believe in myself. And he wouldn't support in any way, shape, or form, you know, me financially. And I knew why. whether I was mad or not on the phone, I knew why. I knew he cared about me. I knew that's what he was doing.
No, he's a tightwad, though. Come on, tell the truth.
Well, I mean, he's a tightwad.
He's squeakfooty wad.
I don't have to. Now I just feel it from him. He's different.
You know, that's atypical because most family members will, you know, will they'll be exasperated about it, but ultimately, you know, if you really need it, you know, I don't feel like I could say no. And now your brother's a good dude, man. Like I said, I first met him in Ramadi that year, and we had just really, really good people over there that whole year, and he was one of them. He was one of the adults that when you were working on really difficult and hard problems, and the division fought its ass off the whole time that we were both there, and just a great dude. And he obviously was right about you. Chris, first of all, one, thanks for coming on and doing All Marine Radio. Two, congratulations on an incredible story of a bit of a roller coaster for the Marine Corps to homeless, suicidal, drug addicted, and then now to a contributing member of the society that that helps people. So good on you, man. Congratulations.
I appreciate it. I appreciate the chance to be on the show for sure. And I really, one of my favorite things to work on is guys that have military experience, you know, and the PTSD and the things that they suffer usually ties to alcoholism and addiction in such a horrific way that I really love working with them whenever I get a chance to. And so if there's anybody out there that needs help, call me even if you don't need an intervention, I'd be happy to help in any way I can.
All Chris's contact information we'll have on the website. So all you have to do is go to the All Marine Radio website, look on podcasts, and in the search window, just type in Kling, K-L-I-N-G, and it'll come bombing up. You'll have all his contact information. Chris, I hope you don't mind in the future when we talk about addiction and interventions and stuff like that, that we give you a call.
No, I would love that.
Okay, and then one more thing. This is just an opinion question. You know, one of the epiphanies I've had since this is the third year that I've done this show, and we don't look at Marines or anybody and say, hey, if you're struggling with post-traumatic stress, you need to stop drinking and stop doing drugs, because if you can successfully deal with post-traumatic stress while you're drinking and doing drugs, you will be the first son of a bitch that ever does that. It doesn't work like that, okay? And all you got to do is look at our history, starting in Vietnam, probably going back before then, but we didn't really talk about it. And it'll tell you, every time it's a loser. Why do you think, are we that averse to looking at people and giving blunt love like that in the military, that we don't want to look at them and say that?
Yeah. It's a great question. I mean, you know the history of drinking as it's associated with the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's literally part of our tradition. It was drinking hard in the bar was part of our pride, and I don't know if that's tied to it, but, you know, guys are dying. And the scary part about guys that are struggling with PTSD and addiction is we don't get to intervene on enough of them because they kill themselves. You know, they cut right to the chase. They do not pass go, and they won't ask for help, and so, you know, but they also, when I've intervened on guys that are military, they are gigantically successful in treatment, much more so than others. I don't know if it's the structure that they connect to, but once they get a little momentum under and are able to step back and see what's going on, I've seen, you know, really great success stories of guys that were ex-military. They just take it serious, they get in there, and they get it done. The problem is we don't get to enough of them, you know.
You know, I will tell you this. I've done this long enough, and I just did an interview last week with a woman by the name of Susie Landolfi from a place called Boulder Crest Retreat. They don't do therapy, right? Because there's a bit of a heavy hand involved in what they do, but they don't call it therapy. They do training. You're not damaged. You're a warrior. You've been a warrior for this country. You signed up for it. You volunteered for it. Your life's different. We're going to now train you how to deal with that difference. You know how to do training. You know how to lead. You know how to fight. And it's nothing that you can't conquer. It's nothing that you can't live with. You'll be fine. Right? But the words that they use are words that we identify with, we understand. And it's very interesting that you make a similar point that she makes. Hey, when we tell people training, they just nod their head. Got it. You've got this issue you've got to deal with. We're going to
be very interested in meeting her or talking to her about her program. That sounds amazing. It's just a different language, but it's a language that makes military get very, very well.
Yeah, as soon as the words come out of their mouth, yeah, we don't do therapy, right? We don't do therapy. We're going to give you these tools. It starts with pre-screening, and then people come and they're at that site for a week, and then they're part of a fire team, and that fire team has another 17 and a half months of work that they have to do together. So they have to stay plugged into each other, which we know how to do. They have to be mutually supporting, which is a life we live. It's the way machine gunners even think. In terms of being mutually supporting. So I think it's very interesting that structure that you talked about and how successful that you said that military people are in that structure. And
yeah,
interesting.
That's
interesting.
Amazing.
All right. No, we will do this again, Chris. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Have a great day. Thanks for having me on.
More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.